Brother Jay, for our second period class.
Well, good Thursday morning to everyone. Today we're going to look at the problems that Ezra and Nehemiah ran into when they made their journey back to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem in particular. And you might recall that they fell into a few different categories. There was marriage problems. There were problems with Sabbath, tithing, usury. And one I'm just going to put into the category of the royal law. First of all, just take time to consider the situation that these people found themselves in. Had they remained familiar with God's word and kept his commandments, they would have remained in the land. Moses told the children of Israel hundreds of years before what would happen to them if they failed to keep the law. The people of Judah saw what happened to their brethren in the northern kingdom because they forsook their God. Jeremiah proclaimed the same fate during the last years of the kingdom of Judah, but few listened or were compelled to action other than to condemn the messenger. Now, after 70 years in captivity, they could look back on what had happened and everything that they had gone through. All had come to pass as Jeremiah had prophesied, and not as had been prophesied by the other false prophets of Jeremiah's time. Additionally, Isaiah, who had prophesied with Cyrus and salvation by his conquest of Babylon long before they even went into captivity, well, that was also right. It would seem there was now every reason to believe God and to keep his commandments. The situation they now found themselves in had already been addressed by Moses had they availed themselves of his message. And we might find the words of Moses more pertinent to the final regathering, but I think it's interesting to read them nonetheless. If we turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 30, Deuteronomy 30. And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations to which the Lord thy God hath driven thee, and thou shalt return unto the Lord thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion on thee and will return and gather thee from all the nations where the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. If any of thine be driven out unto the outmost parts of heaven, from there will the Lord thy God gather thee, and from there will he fetch thee. And the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it. And he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. And the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart and the heart of thy seed to love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. And the Lord thy God will put all these curses upon thine enemies and on them who hate thee, who persecuted thee, and thou shalt return and obey the voice of the Lord and do all his commandments, which I command thee this day. And the Lord thy God will make thee plenteous in every work of thine hand, in the fruit of thy body, and in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of thy land for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over thee for good, as he rejoiced over thy fathers. If thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, and if thou turn unto the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul, for this commandment which I command thee this day, it is not hidden from thee, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that thou shouldest say, who shall go up for us to heaven? Bring it unto us, that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that thou shouldest say, who shall go over the sea for us and bring it unto us, that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near unto thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayest do it. See, I have set before thee this day life and good and death and evil, in that I command thee this day to love the Lord thy God, to keep in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, that thou mayest live and multiply, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in the land to which thou goest to possess it. But if thine heart turn away, so that thou wilt not hear, but shalt be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare unto you this day that ye shall surely perish, and that ye shall not prolong your days upon the land to which thou passest over the Jordan to go to possess it. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him. For he is thy life and the length of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord swore unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. Now this is pretty straightforward. If they would have called this to mind, you would have thought it might have brought a new feeling within them to do the things that were right. And indeed it did, to some extent. When Ezra and Nehemiah came, they were willing to obey. They were willing to see the folly of their error and to follow the way of right. So, when Ezra and later Nehemiah returned to the land, they did, however, find these problems they did not expect, remembering that there's already been a group of people under Zerubbabel and Joshua that have preceded them, allowing them to start to worship again now that they have a temple that has been rebuilt. All of the problems that are involved here are problems that have to do with keeping God's law. So let's look at each of them and see what lessons there may be for us. The first area we're going to look at is marriage. Now, as we look at this verse in Ezra 9:1, this caused Ezra great consternation, and he definitely prayed about this, wanting to know what in the world they, not only what they could do, but what had they done. Now, when these things were done, the princes came to me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves, from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. Now, one of the amazing things that I find about this verse is that the wives were taken from the original banned peoples in the land. That is to say, these people remained in the land during the possession of the children of Israel and on into their captivity and into their return. They're still in the land after all of these years. In addition, there's this other matter that is brought up that has to do with the same thing. But here we see in Ezra 10:18, and among the sons of the priests there were found that had taken strange wives, namely of the sons of Joshua, the son of Jozadak. Now this is the same Joshua that was sent in under Zerubbabel. So of that line, we've got a problem in the line of the leadership. And his brethren that are enumerated there. So, the extent of the problem, as it turned out, was very great, involving many priests, Levites, singers, and the general population. So if we look at Ezra 10, in fact, we'll find all of the people who were involved named. At the beginning of this is Ezra prayed. And if we look at Ezra chapter 9, beginning at verse 6, we'll see that the thing that was on Ezra's mind was the same thing that we just looked at in Deuteronomy chapter 30, the same thing that Moses was talking about. So in Ezra 9, beginning at verse 6, he says, "O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up unto the heavens. Since the days of our fathers have we been in great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, and to a spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. And now for little space grace hath been showed from the Lord our God, to leave us a remnant, to escape, and to give us a nail in this holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes, and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And now, O God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments." So this was the mind of Ezra at the time. And he gathered together all those of like mind who were also upset with the problem that had been shown and brought to light. And fortunately, at that period of time, there was a desire to remedy the situation. Now, Nehemiah had a similar problem. In Nehemiah 13:23 and 24, it says, "In those days also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people." Now Ezra had come in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes, and Nehemiah in the 20th. Nehemiah left Jerusalem in the 32nd year of the king and returned. We don't know, it's not very clear as to how long Nehemiah remained away, but he had this dismay to see what bad practices had emerged in his absence. And we don't know what was become of Ezra at this point in time, because these things seem to be the kinds of things that he would not have tolerated or at all, because things were deteriorating here as Nehemiah was discovering. And there was also a priestly problem in the time of Nehemiah, where we see here in Nehemiah 13:28, "And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite, Therefore, I chased him from me. So then he too would have married a Moabite. Now, one of the questions that comes to my mind is, why would they marry these women? What would prompt them to do this kind of a thing? Well, there are several things in Scripture that give us possibilities. Genesis 6:2 talks about the sons of God saw the daughters of man, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. So there's this possibility that they were physically attracted to these women. In Joshua 15:16, this is one of several I could have chosen, but this is one where Caleb said, "He that smiteth Kirjath Sefer and taketh it, to him will I give Aksah my daughter to wife." And so we have a case where a woman, in this case a noble woman, is given for an act of valor on the part of an individual. Another one that's somewhat more pragmatic is this one. This is the case of Dinah when they were in the land of Shechem, and Shechem wanted to take Dinah, and there was this instance where there was this plan in which they might live together in the land. These men are peaceable. That would be the Israelites or Jacob's family. They are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us take them our daughters. Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. Of course, it didn't work out that way, but that was the plan. An arrangement to acquire power or wealth or status by marrying. And that probably had something to do with the previous slide that we looked at with the priest and Sanballat. Now, under the law, there was a means whereby someone could take a woman that was not of Israel. And that's explained here in Deuteronomy 20, and actually in the next chapter, Deuteronomy 21. When thou comest nigh into a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it, and if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword, but the women and the little ones shalt thou take unto thyself. Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations. Okay, so this would be somebody that they conquered that was not of the land of Israel. This law is interesting because it appears to be an exception in marrying foreign women. And why was that? Well, it's not really made clear. It's just stated to us here. I've often wondered if it could be that the fear of being enticed to fall away to other gods was minimized when the woman was from afar and relocated to Israel without any of her family, where only, supposedly, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was worshipped, whereas women from the land were where they practiced their idolatry to begin with, providing a greater danger. In any case, this may have been the theory, but it did not seem to work out in practice. Even this law did not seem to work out in practice if you take the case of Solomon as an example. There are other laws that regard marriage, and we'll take a look at a few of those right now. Of course, there is this general one regarding marriage that we find with the first family, Adam and Eve, Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Okay, that's good. That's the general institution of marriage. But there were other laws. In Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 and 3, when the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, it hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. So the Israelites were forbidden to make marriages with the inhabitants of the land God was to give them as an inheritance. Things that they were doing right at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, one of the things I always thought was strange about this particular law, it's very clear, but I always wondered, why did it have to be given in the first place? Because there was also this law. But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as thy Lord thy God hath commanded thee. Obviously, there wouldn't be any marriages with these people if they had all been slain as God had commanded. The fact that God gave the commandment not to take wives of the inhabitants of the land shows his foreknowledge regarding this commandment. Now in Deuteronomy 23, we have some additional proscriptions with regard to marriage. It says, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. Also, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. Thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, because thou wast a stranger in his land. The children that are begotten of them shall enter into the congregation of the Lord in their third generation. So in addition to the inhabitants of the land, there were also restrictions regarding other nations around them, the Ammonite and the Moabite. And of course, they also figure in the situation with Ezra and Nehemiah. We might note that the Ammonite and the Moabite are restricted, essentially, it says the 10th generation, but forever, as it says, with the and the reason for that, given in a following verse, was because they didn't come and provide them with bread and water when they passed through their lands. Now, not only do we have those general laws with regard to marriage, but we have laws that are specifically for the priests. In Leviticus 21, at verses 1 and 7, we find that the priests, the sons of Aaron, there shall none be defiled for the dead among his people, and they shall not take a wife that is a whore or profane, neither shall they take a woman put away from her husband, for he is holy unto his God. And in addition to that, there were additional things that were to be observed with regard to the high priest. And he that is the high priest among his brethren, upon whose head the anointing oil was poured, and that is consecrated to put on the garment, shall not uncover his head nor rend his clothes. A widow or a divorced woman or profane or harlot, these shall he not take, but he shall take a virgin of his own people to wife. To Ezra and Nehemiah, this matter showed an utter disregard for the momentary blessing God was giving them, in spite of their history of sin against Him. So the people separated themselves as the only remedy under the law of Moses, and they were strictly enjoined to forsake this practice immediately. Now they came to this conclusion that this was the remedy because they had to, let's put it this way, they had to deduce this because the remedy was not actually in the scriptures as to what they should do, but this is what they decided they needed to do because they were not in strict adherence to the law of Moses. So something had to be done. And this is the main problem that they faced, is they were coming back to the land. God had provided this window for them in order that they might be His people and He might be their God. And right away, they were doing things, turning themselves away and causing a situation that, as Ezra saw it, was something that was only going to be disastrous. Now, we might just consider something that they didn't have at that time, and that's our New Testament look at marriage with, as we might call it, alien women, as identified by Paul in 2 Corinthians. And I think it's always good to read these things again because you have the gist of it in your head, but you don't necessarily have the exact wording of how things are. So in 2 Corinthians 6:14, it says, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." I think that's the sentence we always remember. But then it goes on, "For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing. And I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty." Now, that part where he says, "For ye are the temple of the living God." Now, they had just rebuilt their temple, as it is. And remember when they came and said, "We will help you. We'll help you build. We worship the same God." And they said, "No." They knew, as far as the temple was concerned, that these people didn't have any part with them in this temple and their worship of God. So what in the world gave them the thought that they could take the temple of their bodies and do the very thing they weren't willing to do with the structure that they had put together under the commandment of Cyrus? It's a good thing for us to consider as well. Things that we are not willing to do on one level that may be strictly having to do with our overt being as Christadelphians. But then there are the sublime things, the other things in life that we do that are we do just absolutely contrary, and not realizing, you know, it's the same principle that's involved, and it should be forefront in our minds at all times. Now let's take a look at the Sabbath. That was another issue that came up. Nehemiah writes, "In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves and lading asses, as also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, and I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals." The law was, again, pretty clear. It appears in more than one place, but this one from Deuteronomy 5, 13 and 14. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. All of God's laws require obedience. And, of course, under the law of Moses, there was a curse to those who didn't obey it in its entirety. Now, I think another thing that's well to remember is for ourselves is the record that we have in Hebrews, beginning at the last verse of chapter 3 and going into chapter 4. Talking about the children of Israel in the wilderness and the problems they had, he comes to the conclusion that we see that they could not enter, that is, enter into the promised land, because of unbelief. "Let us, therefore, fear lest a promise, being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them." So the gospel was preached unto them. And I think we can see that in what we've looked at so far. "But the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we have believed, for we who have believed do enter into rest, as he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he spoke in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and the God did rest the seventh day from all his works. And in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest, seeing therefore it remaineth, that some must enter into it. And they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Again, he limiteth a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time as it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that has entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief." This was something to be observed in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the time of Moses as well. Resting on the Sabbath day. But the implications of it, as we see here in Hebrews, is important. And it is a teaching method to teach us that we need to cease from our own works on the Sabbath, which essentially is every day for us. We need to cease from those works and put ourselves forward as the servant of the Lord God. Now, obviously, we have things that we have to do in order to make a living. This is also something that is required of us to take care of our families. But our focus should be on the things that lead to the rest that we are looking to enter. That is what we are to labor for, it says. (Clears throat) Now we have the issue of tithing. And I perceived, Nehemiah 13:10, and I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for the Levites and the singers that did the work. They were fled, everyone to his field. And the implication is they were fled to their field because no one was bringing them their provisions, and so they had to go and provide for themselves. Now, if there's no tithing, there's no Levitical service. The sacrifices can't be made without their help. They were taken, as we recall, back in the Old Testament. They were taken instead of the firstborn for this particular purpose. And so if the people failed to support them in this work, they were failing as the actual firstborn. They were doing what they should not be doing because they were evidently finding that their labors for themselves was of more importance than service to God. And they were thinking, essentially, that they needed to work for themselves rather than to have service to God, because they were going to bring about their own well-being by their own arm. And, of course, this is a problem because that isn't the way it works. And they should have known that just from the earlier time, as we looked at when Zerubbabel and Joshua were working on the temple. The problem that they had is that they were under a problem of drought. And that was caused by God, and it was caused because they were too interested in themselves, taking care of their own houses rather than the house of God. This is, problems like this are, we don't tithe, well, I shouldn't say we don't tithe, but we don't, we're not under the law of tithing as were the people at this time. But the whole idea of providing for service to God first is something that always has to be in our minds. And we cannot think that, times are tough and therefore I'm going to just have to stop doing this. Because the whole thinking then, once again, is that it's all on me. Everything that I have is by my arm. It's not. None of what we have is by our own arm. It's all by the grace of God. Again, the law is very clear. Thus speak unto the Levites and say unto them, when ye take of the children of Israel the tithes which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then ye shall offer up an heave offering of it for the Lord, and even a tenth part of the tithe. So there was a tithe that was supposed to be given of the tithes given to the Levites, and they in turn were to give their tithe to the Lord. And, of course, that couldn't be done either if they weren't receiving the tithes of the people. Again, we can see how interconnected this business is. If God is not the center of the thinking of all of the people or the great majority, things will be very difficult, because if there is not cooperation first in providing for the one who is the provider of all, then things are not going to go well. Then there was a matter of usury. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother, and I set a great assembly against them. Again, we don't know exactly why they were doing this, but it could be for, the usual suspects. Greed, just the idea of wanting to obtain more. It can also be used for control, for leverage, for power, in order to put yourself in a position that is more favorable with respect to to your peers. Anyway, this was not countenanced by Nehemiah at all, and he took the nobles to task. The law, once again, thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to do in the land whither thou goest to possess it. The idea, of course, was to think of yourselves as children of God, all part of the same family, all wanting to help one another to do what was right. And if people start to have the mind of the world, then you start to have very big problems. So let's look at the sort of the overall thing with regard to this. And I bring this up as an example here. This is, as I'm calling it, a problem under the royal law. Here we have, it says, and before this, Eliash of the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobiah. And he had prepared him a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. So, one of the things we wonder is this part of the reason the tithes were no longer being provided the actual inheritance for the Levites? Was it because they made this chamber where all of those provisions were placed, they made it into a chamber for this Tobiah, who is not a person of Israel at all? But for some reason or other, this priest has allied himself unto him. Well, I'm not sure exactly what law exactly was violated here. Polluting the house of the Lord, certainly. But you can just tell that things cannot work in this way. But that is what they had done. So as we recall, the royal law is this: and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And the second is like unto it: thou shalt, and this from Leviticus 19:18, thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. And from Matthew 22:40, we have Jesus' comment on this, which is to say that on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So that, of course, would include the laws we've already looked at regarding marriage, the Sabbath, tithing, and usury. All of these laws hang on these two: that we should love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might, and that we love our neighbor as ourself. Now, what I would like to do, because of course this, having this in our minds is a good way to keep in mind any of the commandments. If it cannot pass this test, what we are about to do cannot pass the test that's involved here about loving, then there's a problem with whatever it is that we are about to do. So it is good to have that always on our mind and to consider making the test before we attempt anything that may be hurtful either to our Heavenly Father or to those around us. Now, I'd like to go at this point and end this class with going back to the psalm, actually, that I mentioned on Sunday, Psalm 105. Because this is, you know, this is the way we should be viewing what God does. God tells us about himself. We should listen to that. And we should approach the things that we do with the same, with a confidence that what he says about himself is true. We won't read the whole psalm, but let's begin at verse 1, Psalm 105. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him. Sing praises unto him. Talk ye of all his wondrous works. Glory ye in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord in his strength. Seek his face evermore. Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders and the judgments of his mouth. O ye seed of Abraham, his servant, ye children of Jacob, his chosen, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He hath remembered his covenant forever. The Lord, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations, which covenant he made with Abraham and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant, saying, unto thee will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance, when they were but few men in number, yea, very few, and sojourners in it. When they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, he permitted no man to do them wrong. Yea, he reproved kings for their sake, saying, touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm. And then, skipping down to verse 42, for he remembered his holy promise and Abraham his servant, and he brought forth his people with joy and his chosen with gladness, and gave them the lands of the nations, and they inherited the labor of the peoples, that they might observe his statutes and keep his laws. Praise ye the Lord.